The ship ahoy. The White Gull was the really nice motel in town. The Bernaysis had run it since 1964, and they kept it up, with white trim renewed every few years on the 16 shingled cabins, firewood for the fireplaces, a flower box by every doorstep, good stoves and refrigerators in the kitchenettes. The last few years, they were asking $60 a night for the ocean view cabins, and on weekends in the season taking reservations only for two-night occupancy, and still filled up every weekend. Mrs. Bernaysi wore dresses, never pants. She was a religious-minded woman, attending Sunday Mass at St. Joseph's up the coast and various retreats and Catholic women's meetings. Mr. Bernaysi would tell people right to their faces that if they wanted to have loud drinking parties or behave immorally, they could go to another motel in another town. They were strict people, the Bernaysis. Their son had not turned out well. He had raised hell in high school and run off to Portland and become some kind of hippie, and they did not even know where he lived now. Somebody told Tim Marion at the gas station that he had AIDS and was in San Francisco. But the Bernaysis were good neighbors, and the White Gull was a place people in town could be proud of. Then across the loop road, up in the spruce and alder woods, was Hannah's hideaway. Most people thought Hannah was a woman it was named for. But people like Mr. Voder could tell you that the man who built it way back in the Depression years had been named John Hannah, an eccentric Portlander with lumber money. He had started out building a cabin for himself there in the woods above Clatson Creek, when there wasn't anything much in town but an old falling-down hotel and the general store, and a few houses and summer cabins scattered around between the road and the beach. The Loop Road was the main road then, before they built the Coast Highway. John Hannah built his wife a second cabin, a sort of tower, two rooms, one on top of the other. He said she got on his nerves sitting knitting in his cabin. Then some friend of his came to visit, and John Hannah built a cabin for him. And some more friends came to visit. It ended up with seven different cabins sitting there in the woods on 2.5 acres. After the Hannah estate sold it, there were times the hideaway had been, as Mr. Voder said, a very shady retreat, rented out to parties of men who brought their liquor by the case and their women by the carload and never came into town at all. Other owners had cleaned up the old cabins and made it almost a private club kind of resort. In the 70s it had changed hands again and run down into an on-again, off-again, second-rate seasonal motel. Now that the Shodos had it, it was doing a lot of week-long and even month-long summer rentals, and a nicer kind of people stayed there, although there was still something a little queer about the place. All those cabins with their gables and dormers and ladder lofts in the thick woods, compared to the White Gull right in town at the top of the beach, with its white trim and sunny marigolds. And then there was the Ship Ahoy. The Tucketts took over the Ship Ahoy in the mid-80s, when it was pretty badly run down. It never had amounted to much, a double row of jerry-built cabins with a carport between each pair, on a U-shaped driveway with a grass plot in the middle. The office and apartment were on the right coming in, and a storage building connected the two rows at the west end. The four cabins on the left had kitchens and could sleep five apiece. The three on the right were duplexes, a room and bath with one queen or two twin beds. All the showers were some kind of plastic unit made for motels, installed when the place was built in the 50s, and they were really decrepit by now, cracked through, with dirt in the cracks, and leaking. The faucets were cranky, and the plumbing was explosive. The TV sets were huge old things fixed on imitation wood stands. In the smaller rooms, you could barely get between them and the foot of the bed. Most of the sets picked up three or four of the five cable channels available, but none of them got all of them. The bedspreads and curtains and carpets of all the rooms smelled of cigarettes and mildew, and the equipment in the kitchens was sorry. Groaning refrigerators, stoves with dead burners, a couple of thin pots, a scratched, no-stick frying pan that stuck, table knives and forks from the Goodwill, one dull serrated cutting knife, and odd plastic plates and cups that had been scraped and scorched and battered and worn till their aggressive pink and orange and aqua and chartreuse colors had gone whitish-gray. But then the Tucketts seemed a little run down, too. He had been in the Marines, how long and how long ago nobody knew, but it was about all anybody did know about him. His first name was Bob, and this was his second marriage. People learned that from Mrs. Tucket. She joked that when she married Mr. Tucket she ought to have changed her name to Nan. But it was Rose Marie, and she had been married before, too. But she didn't say more about it than that. She was friendly enough, and pleasant-mannered, but But people knew her only in the stores and from when she chatted with Tim at the filling station or had to have Bigley come out for the plumbing, that kind of thing. She did not get to know any women in town well, for the motel kept her on a short chain. She hired no help to run it, and did almost everything herself. Mr. Tuckett had some kind of health condition that got worse soon after they bought the Ship Ahoy. He could not move furniture or do any heavy work. He wheezed and looked shaky even when he ran the heavy old vacuum cleaner. Mostly he sat in the apartment living room and watched NBC, and answered the bell when anybody telephoned or came to the office to ask for a room. Nobody ever made reservations at the Ship Ahoy, except maybe on the really big weekends, Memorial Day, Sandcastle Day at Cannon Beach, the 4th, and Labor Day. People just saw the sign up on the highway as they drove by, or the Gull and Hannah's filled up and sent people to it. It was on the loop road a little out of town to the south. It didn't have a sea view, but was only one block of sandy road and a bit of dune grass away from the beach. It could have been a nice little place, and no doubt Rosemary and Bob Tuckett had meant to make it nicer, or anyway Rosemary had, since he seemed to be one of those men who never meant anything they did, but just got angry when it didn't come out right. Rosemary had talked with people in town about some of the things she hoped to do with the Ship Ahoy to fix it up and make it more attractive. She did plant petunias in front of the office, first thing. She made a good deal on weekly linen and towel rental with a nice young couple starting an agency in Astoria. The first week they had the place, she threw out the old bedspreads that were fit for nothing but furniture packing and hounds to lie on in the back of pickups. She bought pale green fiber-filled coverlets that served both as blanket and bedspread and were fireproof. All a cigarette could do to them was melt a hole with hard brown edges. Several guests with cigarettes did so pretty soon. It took more money than she had figured on to buy the 6 queen, 4 double, and 12 twin spreads for the 10 units. She kept the best of the old bedspreads for the rollaways and sofa beds. She bought good curtain material, beige with wide pale green stripes, and sewed the drapes for the front kitchen units, the best ones, 1 and 2. But putting in the hooks for the drapery installation took so long, it would take forever to make curtains for all the units, hundreds of hooks to be sewn in. When was she to do it? At night the light wasn't good enough to sew by. Cleaning up the units to be ready by 2 p.m. took the whole morning, and there was their own apartment to keep clean, and meals to cook and clear, and she had to have some time to herself. Hadn't they looked for a motel in a small town, a beach town, so that they could have some time free? She had never minded being alone. Indeed, she would have enjoyed it, if she had had time to enjoy it. Certainly she hadn't planned to socialize with the guests. That might be what people wanted at these fancy bed and breakfasts, where there was champagne and orange juice and everybody used first names. But most people at motels wanted to be left alone, she thought, and all she wanted was to greet them in a nice way so they felt at home, take their money, and give them their key, and then clean up after them next morning. And she knew what that involved. Working at her first husband's service station in Tucson years ago, she had learned how people use public facilities, not only peeing on the floor and strewing paper around, but scraping off paint, unscrewing fixtures, uprooting toilets even, like crazy monkeys wrecking their cage. She didn't expect the cleaning to be pleasant, and sometimes it was disgusting. You wanted to rub their noses in it. But then some people left things neat, the wet towels in a pile, trash in the waste baskets, sometimes even a dollar bill under the ashtray, as if she was a maid. But they meant well. And nobody came here for big wild parties, like in city motels. Mostly they were just driving through on the coast highway and pulled off for the night. Single men, a good many elderly couples, some families with young children. Sometimes women staying with their families in the kitchen units for a couple of nights liked to talk with her while the children were down playing on the beach. Mostly they started out with a complaint about the refrigerator or the shower, or they wanted extra cups, but sometimes they also got to talking about their lives, and that was interesting. In some of them she recognized right away the pain and strangeness she felt in her own life, but others interested her because they seemed to be so dull and so familiar, and the women living these lives complained about them comfortably, feeling no strangeness at all. Such conversations usually took place in the front office or at the doorway of the units. Once, an elderly lady staying alone for the weekend for a church conference up in Seaside invited her in for a glass of iced tea. Rosemary did not feel that she should accept the invitation and did not want to accept it, but she appreciated it. The apartment kitchen was cramped. The living room was dark because Bob kept the blind down and the TV on, and it smelled like his socks. Since he was always there to answer the bell, Rosemary took to spending a good deal of time that fall in the storage room. It had the only west window in the motel, looking down through some big old black Sitka spruce trees to the grassy dunes. You couldn't see the sea, but you could hear it, if you wanted to. Or she would lie down on one of the twin beds in number 10, a unit they had never rented, even in the summer, saving it till last, because its TV and heating unit both acted funny. She would lie down on the bed farther from the door and look at a mail-order catalog, or doze and think at the same time. Sometimes she read science fiction books or magazines from the second-hand paperback bookstore in Astoria. She had never liked what they called women's books. She did not like most of these, either, the ones that were about wars and drugs and killing, like the newspapers and everything else, but some of them told stories about places that were different from here. She wondered where the writers got their ideas from. She spread the untouched pale green coverlet back across the bed and went back to the storage room to put the wash in the dryer. She looked out at the edge of the land, the dune grass bowing in the sea wind, and pretended that if you walked down the sandy road past the spruce trees and the empty lots and stood there on the edge, you would see something entirely different. Not the long, wide brown beach and the breakers and the gray horizon, but another world. A city with glass towers, maybe. Pointed green glass towers like thin church steeples. A person came up from that green city towards her. He shone, with a kind of shimmering and sparkling at the edges and in his hair, because he was an energy person. Not flesh and blood, not earthly. She did not dare take his hand, although he held it out. She was afraid the touch would destroy her, until he smiled and said, "It's all right." Then she smiled at him, or at herself daydreaming, and finished loading the dryer. But she remembered him. He was sad, in trouble, she thought, another day, after she had cleaned 2 and 6 and put new blue deodorant blocks in the toilet tanks and emptied the vacuum for Bob and was opening a box of plastic glasses for the bathrooms. It was raining and the rain beat on the window of the storage room. Through the water-wavery glass, the old black spruces moved their stiff arms. Beyond them, the top of the dunes was pale against gray-black cloud. She thought what it would be like if he came up over the edge of the dunes and down the sandy road. He needed help. He was in trouble. He had been driven out of the green city because the other energy people did not understand him. He had enemies and was in danger, perhaps because he could talk to people in her world. She went to number 10 and dusted the lamps and the TV before she took off the coverlet and her shoes and lay down on the twin bed farther from the door. If she could take him in and let him stay here, he would be safe. He could stay in number 10. "You can come in," she whispered. Bob never looked in the units anymore. It was easy enough. She told him not to put anybody in 10 till she could get the TV fixed, and she fiddled with the fine-tuning and the vertical hold till it was completely out of whack, in case Bob got a fit of trying to fix it himself. He had used to be pretty handy with repairs, but it seemed that since they bought the motel, instead of fixing it up like they had planned, he only wanted to sit and watch TV like one of the guests instead of the owner. And there was so much to do, she could never catch up. In a way, it was lucky so few people were coming now, in the rainy fall. The shower and two, their best unit, had kind of split right down the back wall. The family with the teenagers from Illinois had spilled what must have been beer on the queen bed in 4. Even after she poured scented deodorant disinfectant right on the mattress, the beery smell came back, only with a sort of bubblegum flavor to it. Once it dried, probably people wouldn't notice. But she had wanted the place to be nice, not fancy, but homey, so that nice families would come back with little kids. She didn't mind little kids, the way some motel managers did. She loved getting the old crib out of the storage room. Kids of 6 or 7 were hard on the TVs, but there really wasn't anything else they could hurt, and what did it matter anyway? "If I used my energy," her friend said, with his lovely smile, and she said, "If you used your energy?" All the rooms would be painted white to start with. "Oh, no," she said. "I wanted each unit different, see? 1 pink, and 2 peach, and 3 aqua blue, and 4 daffodil." He smiled, shaking his bright head. "All pure white," he said. "Energy white, but with different colored carpets, and curtains, red and white checked, Blue and white, yellow and white. Oh, curtains, she said, her heart sinking at the thought of that huge bolt of material, green and beige striped. But he laughed again, laughed at her so kindly that she had to laugh at herself too. It's all right. I'll handle the curtains, he said. And he did, for the time being, anyhow. She was not foolish about him. When she read in The Sun or The Enquirer about space aliens and flying saucer visits, she enjoyed the stories, but they were just like the science fiction. If you began to believe all that, you'd be in trouble. Her friend was different, because he was only a kind of game of make-believe or a gift to her, and because he needed her. It wasn't like the saucer people, who always knew everything and were sent to save people. Although he helped her in her daydreams, it was because he needed her help, because he was in trouble. Bob had a gallbladder attack after Christmas. He thought it was his heart and was terrified. But it was so much like his first attack 2 years ago that she was pretty sure it was gallbladder and was not too frightened, though the drive at night up the coast to the hospital was very like a nightmare in the hard black rain, with Bob gasping for air, panicked. He would not listen to her trying to reassure him, or even to the doctor, even after he was home, though he did stop eating so much potato chips and pork skins and boughten popcorn while he watched TV. He went on saying it had been his heart. She heard him say it to a guest checking in at the front desk. Had some heart trouble lately. Can't get around much for a while. He would talk with some of the guests. She never could figure out which ones or why, and then with the next ones be as sour and mean as an old hyena. It was all right in January when you weren't well, and hardly anybody came anyway. But if you're going to be in the office registering guests, you got to shave, she said to him in March, after the family of four from Washington looked at number three and then said, thank you, embarrassed. They were nice young people with pretty children, and got back in their car and drove on south. I'll shave when I damn want to, he said. Quit your damn nagging. As if she had said one word to him from the night she drove him to the hospital to this day, one word anything but cheerful. She hadn't even felt cross with him, only sorry for him, even when he sort of boasted about his heart trouble. But now his rudeness turned her against him, like the slam of a door. She could not bear the sight of his gray stubbled chin. She wanted to cry looking at it. It was so ugly. She went off to the storage room without a word, though when she got there, she did not know what she had meant to do there. It was late afternoon, and there was only one unit occupied. A young man had come in before noon yesterday. He had a junk food complexion and a dull look, like the photos in newspapers of the man whose neighbors say, he was always real quiet, after he kills his wife, the four-year-old, the baby, the babysitter, and finally gets around to himself, which he would much better have tended to in the first place. Rosemary was not at all afraid of this young man, but she thought him creepy, and she put him into nine, where the TV only picked up two channels, because it seemed the right room for him. And she never could talk herself out of the notion that all the better units should be held for the nice families that were going to come later in the day. The young man paid cash and made no complaints. He stayed shut up with his two-channel TV all afternoon, as far as she noticed what he did. Later in the afternoon, a couple in their 50s from Montana wanted a kitchen unit. She gave them Unit 1, still saving three for the nice family. And when they did come, Bob scared them off. The Montana couple paid with Visa, and Rosemary could tell that they would leave the room clean. Then, past 8 last night, a man in a pickup with Canadian license plates came in with a crunch of gravel and a slam of the car door, and was in the office before she could get there, saying in a big, booming, beery voice, "All I want's a bed, lady, dead on my feet." Bob had taken over from her, and had put the man in three, which she wouldn't have done, $20 extra for a kitchen he wouldn't use. But he didn't complain, either. His light went off 5 minutes after he went into the unit. He had left before sunrise. She had heard the pickup's wheels on the gravel, and then the crows began their morning cawing, and the singing birds turned up inland in the alder woods. She had got up early and had breakfast by herself. She cleaned three, and then after she had made Bob's breakfast and saw the Montana car leave, she cleaned one, which they had left clean, as she expected. As she was coming out of the unit with a mop bucket and plastic bags, the young man in nine had come across the gravel towards her, not looking at her. "Thought I might stay another night," he said in a kind of mumbling, sneering tone. It probably was shyness. Young men did such strange things to disguise their shyness. but it was unpleasant all the same, the way he looked past her. She nodded and said, "Just tell Mr. Tuckett. He's in the office. Just pay him. You need towels or anything?" He turned away without response. It annoyed her. Even if they didn't have to be all over each other friendly, people could have manners, not just cut each other off. Even if he was young, he didn't have to be rude. Some men treated every woman over 30 like their mother, like dirt. She wasn't his mother, thank God. Even if he was young, he could start noticing other people existed. Probably he was a lonely person himself, or else why would he be here, a man in his 20s by himself, not doing anything, not even going down to the beach, as far as she knew, just going into town for dinner and back by 9 last night. But he wasn't going to make any friends by cutting people off like that, not even no thanks, just turning away. She stood in the storage room at the window, looking down the sandy road to the edge, but she could not think about her friend, only of what had to be done so that nice people wouldn't look at the units and go on to another motel. Because it wasn't just Bob's fault. But there were so many, many, many things that had to be done to each one of the units, and they could not get more in debt. They were spending Bob's marine pension to eat on, and it was still 3 years before she could start Social Security. She had the green and beige material, and the sewing machine, and the hooks. She could make new curtains. That was the first thing she could do. She ought to do it. The material had been expensive. But she could not bear it, sewing in those endless hooks for the out-of-date fixtures. She went to 10 and let herself in with the passkey. The little room was dim and stuffy. It did not smell clean. "I'll just lie down a moment first," Rosemary thought, distinctly, as if the words were saying themselves, and she was listening to them. She took the new coverlet off the bed farther from the door, folding it on the other bed, and pushed off her shoes, and lay down. She lay still and began to see the sandy road. There was someone on it, but his back was turned, and she heard something terrible, and did not know what it was. It was a crying. The young man was in his room, and he was crying. There was nothing but the thin wall between the head of this bed and the head of his bed. She could hear or feel his bed shake, and hear him crying. Not stifled sobbing, but terrible, hoarse, short screams of pain or grief or fear. "I can't stand this. I can't bear this. What shall I do?" said the words in Rosemary's mind. She got up, slipped on her shoes, replaced the coverlet with shaky hands, and hurried out of the room. She stood in the pale, foggy sunlight on the rutted gravel in front of 9 and 10. She could not hear the crying from outside. There was no sound at all but the low undertone that was always there of the sea and the wind and the cars up on the highway. She wanted to knock on the door of 9, but she could not do it. She could not use the passkey. She did not deserve to. She was afraid. She thought as hard as she could, trying to send the energy through the door, to send the words to him. "It's all right. It will be all right. You're young. It will get better. Don't cry." But it was no good. Like her friend, she could not help him.